We've been dreaming about a perfect kitchen, but where do we even start?
The Creative Kitchen Company. We're your complete design build company for custom kitchens and bathrooms. From initial planning to installation, we'll help you realize your vision.
And no surprise fees or endless upselling?
Never. We provide realistic upfront costs and clear communication through our mobile app so you can track every detail. Don't just settle for any kitchen or bathroom. Call us today at 614-971-3448 for a free in-home consultation or visit thecreativekitchenco.com.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Grown Up Stuff.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
They aren't saying he didn't do it. They aren't saying the DNA doesn't match. They're now saying it was planted. That's the new twist in the Brian Koberger case, a defense strategy that's either a masterstroke of reasonable doubt or a legal equivalent of throwing a Hail Mary from the other side of the field and hoping the jury somehow catches it. Let's be clear, this isn't some technical challenge to the science behind DNA testing. This isn't a lab messing up where the cops use the wrong test. This is an outright accusation that someone somewhere deliberately framed Koberger by planting his DNA on the knife sheath found at the scene of the University of Idaho murders. He's going full on OJ. It's a strategy that immediately shifts the burden of proof. Not just for the defense, but for the prosecution, who now has to make sure the jury believes their crime scene integrity is airtight. So let's get into it. Why now? Why this? And does it actually hold water? From the start, Koberger's defense team has been playing the game of survival. They know the DNA on the knife sheath is a major problem. It was found at the crime scene near one of the victims, and forensic testing linked it straight to Koberger. That's not circumstantial, that's direct evidence, something that can't be explained away with a shrug and a wrong place, wrong time excuse. And for a while, it seemed like the defense might take the standard route on this, challenging the validity of the DNA collection, question the methods used, cast doubt on lab procedures. And they tried. Now, they've made an aggressive pivot, essentially saying, yeah, that's his DNA, but it got there because someone put it there. just like that, with the finger in the air. Someone put it there. It's a risky move because now they have to convince a jury that a third party, maybe law enforcement, maybe someone else, went through the trouble of collecting Koberger's DNA, transferring it onto a knife sheath button strap, and planting it at the crime scene in a way that made it look completely natural. Yeah. It's a tall order. It really is. For one, DNA doesn't just magically appear. If you're going to plant it, you need a legitimate source, an object Koberger had handled, a biological sample, his finger cut off and jammed into the knife sheath. They checked his hands, right? He has all of his... Really wanted to do this? He wanted to get out of jail free card? He should have cut one of his fingers off and said, oh my God, I woke up and my finger had been cut off. There you go. Be off the hook when they finally found him. Wasn't thinking ahead. Wasn't using that criminal PhD mind of his. Now, was he? I digress. You need something real that forensic analysts wouldn't immediately flag as tampered with. Because you can tell things are tampered with, too. And if you have that, you have to get the DNA onto the knife sheath in a way that makes sense. If it's touch DNA, it needs to be on the right parts of the sheath, not just randomly smeared on. If it's blood or skin cells, there has to be a logical reason for it to be there. And this is where the defense is going to run into some problems, per se. Because if you're claiming a frame-up, you need to explain how it was done. You need a story that actually fits. You can't just point at the evidence and go, conspiracy! Just like, it was you! And expect the jury to go along with it. They're going to want details. And how did the DNA get there? Who put it there? And why would they go to the trouble of framing Brian Koberger? And most importantly, if this was a setup, why wasn't more evidence planted to reinforce this story? We're just going to put it right here and that's it and hope to God they figure it out. The last question is the one that's really hurting the defense's case. If you were truly framing someone, wouldn't you only plant one piece of evidence? Would you just leave one knife sheath at the crime scene and call it a day? Or would you go all out, leave his fingerprints on the bodies or something? Some element of him. Just kind of shivering thinking of that. His shoe prints in the blood, his hair on the victim's clothes, something. But somehow you got touch DNA? How do you even... That's what you got. Hair, maybe? Blood? Okay, here's the problem. The prosecution's case against Koberger isn't just DNA. They got the cell phone records, surveillance footage, eyewitness testimony from a surviving witness, the roommate who saw a masked figure in the house with bushy eyebrows, about the same height. If someone was truly framing Koberger, why wouldn't they just make it airtight? Why wouldn't they go for overkill? That's what makes this defense so hard to sell. It asks the jury to believe that someone went to the trouble of planting Brian Koberger's DNA as evidence, but stopped there. And that's a tough sell. Now, there's always a possibility that the defense doesn't actually expect the jury to fully buy into the theory. They just need to introduce doubt, reasonable doubt, and that's their golden ticket. Look, it's a real piece of gold, Dad. No, it's not. What is that? I don't know. You know what this is? It bends, but it glows. It's some weird material out of, I don't know what even country this comes out of. Is it their golden ticket? They don't need to prove a full-scale conspiracy. They just need to make the jury hesitate for a second and think, well, maybe. That's enough for a not guilty verdict. Or a hung jury. But even if that is going to, even that is going to be a big challenge here. Juries don't like conspiracy theories unless there's proof. Even when there is, they don't like conspiracy theories all that much. They don't want vague insinuations of corruption or tampering. They want concrete examples, damn it. And unless a defense can produce some kind of evidence, a break in the chain of custody, a procedural mistake, a forensic inconsistency, it's going to be an uphill battle. So what's their game plan? First, they're likely going to focus on reasonable alternative suspects. They'll highlight the fact that three unknown DNA samples were found under the fingernails of one of the victims. That's not nothing. If there's other DNA at the scene that doesn't belong to Koberger, then who does it belong to? They'll also go after the credibility of the investigation. Were there any errors in how evidence was handled? Were there any officers involved who had a reason to target Brian Koberger? And finally, they might try to capitalize on public skepticism about forensic integrity. There have been cases, though rare, where evidence was manipulated, where forensic experts got it wrong, where people were falsely accused based on bad science. That defense, they're going to want to plant that seed in the jury's mind. They're going to basically just throw out bags and bags of seeds and hope something grows. I know they're all expired and they've been sitting in a really hot barn all year, but maybe they'll grow again. Or not. But again, without concrete proof, this defense runs the risk of backfiring. Because when you accuse law enforcement of planting evidence, you'd better be able to prove it. Otherwise, the jury sees it for what it is. Desperation. It's kind of what we're looking at right now. And if they see it as desperation, if they think this is just a last-ditch effort to throw something at the wall to see what sticks, that's going to hurt Koberger more than help him. This isn't just about the legal mechanics. This is about narrative control. And right now, the prosecution story is simple. Koberger's DNA was found at the crime scene near the victims. The defense, on the other hand, is trying to make things messy. They want confusion. They want doubt. But the risk is that they overplay their hand. And instead of looking like a strong, well-reasoned argument, they come across as grasping at straws. And if that happens, they could end up doing the prosecution's job for them. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with a battle of credibility. The defense will argue that the entire case against Koberger rests on one piece of evidence, the knife sheath. That it can't be trusted, and that if it can't be trusted, the prosecution will counter that. The DNA is just one part of a much larger puzzle, and that there's too much evidence pointing to Koberger for this to be a coincidence. And in the end, it's going to come down to what the jury believes. Do they see this as a legitimate challenge to the forensic evidence? Or do they see it as a desperate attempt to muddy the waters? That's the real question. And it's one we're going to get answers to sooner or later. But before we get there, we have to go back to the foundations of this case. Because before we can talk about whether the defense has a chance, we need to fully understand the evidence itself, where it came from, what it tells us, and, you know, exactly what's missing. The knife sheath is the single most damning piece of evidence in the case against Brian Koberger. It wasn't just found near the victims. It was left in plain sight next to one of the bodies. And if someone had intentionally discarded it and attached to that sheath a small but significant trace of DNA that investigators say matches Koberger, the defense doesn't dispute that it's his DNA, but they claim he didn't put it there. So let's get to the heart of it. If the sheath really wasn't his, or if it really wasn't at the scene, naturally, what does that mean? How did it get there? And more importantly, how does a jury make sense of it? To start with, forensic DNA analysis and not some TV drama magic trick. DNA doesn't just float through the air and land where it's most convenient. It has to be deposited either by direct touch, transfer from another object, or through some kind of contamination. If Koberger's DNA was on that sheath in a way that made sense, on the snap button, the fabric, or the edges where someone might naturally grip it, then the prosecution has a straightforward case. If it was found in an unnatural place in an amount inconsistent with handling, then the defense might have an argument. But here's the catch. The DNA was found on the button snap of the sheath, which is exactly where you'd expect it if someone had opened or closed it. That's a problem for the defense because it suggests direct contact. If this were truly planted evidence, it would have to be in a way that mimicked natural use, not just smeared on randomly. This is where the chain of custody comes in. The chain of custody is the step-by-step record of who handles the evidence, when, and how. Any break in that chain, a missing log, an unexplained gap in the timeline, opens the door to reasonable doubt. The defense will dig through every single document looking for any irregularity that they can use to suggest tampering. But as of now, there's no documented gap, no clear mistake, no missing evidence log that would indicate the sheath was compromised before testing. That doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means the defense has an uphill battle convincing a jury that a professional crime scene investigation either got this completely wrong or was complicit in fabricating evidence. And that's a much harder sell than just saying the DNA is wrong. Then there's the issue of location tracking. Koberger's cell phone records put him near the victim's house multiple times before the murders, which is exactly the kind of detail you'd expect in a premeditated crime. But the real red flag, his phone was turned off during the time frame of the murders and then turned back on afterwards. Now, if you're thinking, well, maybe his phone just died, that's a reasonable assumption. For an average person, but for a PhD student in criminology, someone who studied criminal behavior, someone hyper aware of how investigations work, turning off your phone at the precise time of a crime being committed, that's intentional. And by the way, when they look at the phone log data, which they I'm sure are doing and have done, you can see battery power. And they'll be able to tell if it was just that, just the battery going out and then he got to charge it up again. Or if it was, boop, power's going off, boop, power's going back on because there's still a charge. They can tell. It's like pulling the batteries out of a security camera right before a break-in. Doesn't prove guilt, but it's the kind of detail that doesn't look good in context. If this were a coincidence, you'd expect him to have a reason, an explanation, but so far the defense hasn't given one. And until they do, the prosecution will hammer home this point. People don't just turn off their phones at the exact moment a quadruple homicide takes place unless they have a reason to. But even if the phone wasn't in use, there was something that was. A car. That car. His car. Surveillance footage caught a white Hyundai Elantra, the same make and model as Koberger's, circling the neighborhood multiple times before and after the murders. That's another piece of evidence that makes the prosecution's case stronger than just DNA. Because here's the thing, if all they had was just DNA, the defense might have an easier time introducing doubt. But when you add in the car being there, the phone tracking, his movements, the DNA linking him to the crime scene, it paints a bigger picture. The kind of picture that isn't easily explained away by coincidence. Now, the defense is likely to argue that there are thousands of white Hyundai Elantras on the road, and that's true. But the reason this car stands out is where it was, when it was there, and how it was behaving. It wasn't just passing through, it was circling, it was lingering, and then it was gone. If the defense wants to argue mistaken identity, they have to explain why another identical car was acting suspiciously at that exact place and time. And while they're at it, they'll have to explain something else, why Koberger's DNA was found at the scene. But other DNA was found too. This is where things get murky. Investigators found DNA from three unidentified individuals under the fingernails of one of the victims. That doesn't necessarily mean anything sinister. People touch things, people touch other people. But it does mean that there are traces of other individuals present. And in a high-traffic college house, that is really not all that surprising. The defense will argue that this is reasonable doubt, that the presence of unknown DNA suggests the possibility of another attacker. The prosecution will counter that just because other people's DNA was present doesn't mean they were killers. Check under almost anyone's fingernails, you'll probably find DNA. The only forensic evidence that directly ties to a suspect is a knife sheath, and unless the defense can find a compelling way to challenge it, that's what a jury will remember. And that brings us to one of the biggest missing pieces in this case, the murder weapon itself. It has not been found. No knife, no bloody blade, nothing. And that's an issue for the prosecution because juries like tangible proof. They like to see the weapon that did it, the smoking gun, the conclusive piece of the puzzle. And right now that's missing. So what does that mean for the case? And for the defense, it's an opportunity. If the prosecution can't produce the murder weapon, they can argue that the state is asking the jury to take a leap of faith. For the prosecution, it means that they have to build their case on everything else, the DNA, the surveillance, the phone records. If they can convince the jury that the rest of the evidence is enough, they don't really need the weapon. Clearly, nobody just did this with their fingernails and stabbed themselves. There was a weapon. The fact that we don't have it at this moment in time, I don't think that that's really going to sway a jury a whole lot. Maybe I'm wrong. But if the defense can convince even one juror that the missing knife is too big of a hole to ignore, that's all they need to do to hang a jury. So that's where we stand. The prosecution has a strong case, but it's not without its gaps. The defense has room to create doubt, but no solid proof of a frame-up. And that's why this trial is shaping up to be one of the most complex, high-stakes cases we've seen ever. Because at the end of the day, the jury isn't just weighing evidence. They're deciding whether this story is that's being told is even making sense. And if there's one thing we know about the legal system, it's that the best story wins. The question is, which one is going to be more believable? Brian Koberger doesn't act like most people facing a quadruple homicide charge. He doesn't fidget. He doesn't appear nervous. He doesn't look away awkwardly or shift in his seat like someone who knows their life could be over soon. Instead, he sits in the courtroom with his strange, almost unsettling calm, absorbing everything around him. He watches, but he doesn't react. He listens, but he doesn't respond. And that raises a fundamental question. What's going on in his head? This is a guy with a PhD-level understanding of criminal behavior. Before his arrest, he wasn't just studying crime. He was obsessed with it. He wanted to know how criminals think, how investigations unfold, how cases are built. And he didn't just observe from a distance, he actively inserted himself into the field, applying for an internship with law enforcement just months before the murders. He wanted inside access to criminal investigations. The same guy who now sits in that courtroom, stone-faced, was once asking cops about how criminals avoid detection. Now he's the one being analyzed. If Koberger is guilty, it wouldn't be the first time a highly intelligent offender believed they could outmaneuver the system. There's a long history of criminals with advanced knowledge of law enforcement procedures overestimating their ability to get away with it. They think they're smarter than the people investigating them. They think they understand how to erase their tracks. But there's one thing that's always seeming to trip them up. Ego. If Koberger is innocent, then his behavior in court makes a different kind of sense. He's not panicking because he truly believes this isn't happening. He's detached because he's watching the system wrongfully convict him in real time, something he's been studying years and years studying. In that scenario, his lack of emotional reaction isn't coldness, it's disbelief. Here's where it also gets tricky. Whether guilty or innocent, Koberger doesn't present like a typical defendant. Most people facing life in prison or worse show some kind of reaction. They plead, they cry, they crumble under the weight of it all. Koberger doesn't. And that could be a problem for him. Juries expect human emotion. They look for guilt, remorse, even fear. When they don't see any of it, they start to fill in the blanks. They'll interpret it. And in Koberger's case, the lack of visible emotion could be working against him. It makes him harder to read, harder to relate to, and much easier to paint as someone capable of detachment, even in the face of extreme violence. And there's also the issue of the surviving roommate. One of the most chilling details in this case is that she was awake during the attack. She saw a masked figure in the house. She froze. She didn't call police right away, and she never got a clear look at the man's face. But here's the question. If this was a frame-up, who did she actually see? Because if you believe the defense's theory, that masked figure wasn't Koberger. That means someone else was in the house wearing a mask, killing four people, and making sure to leave behind the knife sheath with his DNA on it. That's an extremely specific way to frame someone. It's not just planting DNA, it's orchestrating an entire scene, leaving just enough evidence, just enough, to incriminate one person while remaining unseen themselves. It's not impossible, but it's more than highly unlikely. And then there are the text messages and the moments following the attack. The surviving roommates, they were texting each other, confused, scared, trying to piece together what had just happened. They didn't immediately recognize what had occurred, and by the time 911 was called, it was hours later. This is important because if someone was trying to frame Koberger, those messages would have been a risk. They would have been the moment someone else slipped up, the moment an outsider was seen, heard, or noticed. But there's nothing, no indication that anyone outside of the crime scene was present. Juries will have to make sense of all of this. They'll have to decide whether the defense's claim that an unknown person carefully framed Koberger by planting DNA on a single object is more likely than what the prosecution is arguing. That he did this and he left behind the sheath by accident. The defense doesn't need to prove the frame-up actually happened. They just need to make the jury doubt of the prosecution's versions of events. And that's how reasonable doubt works. Here's the problem. Juries trust forensic evidence. They don't typically buy into conspiracy theories unless they have something solid to hold on to. If the defense wants to convince jurors that someone framed Koberger, they're going to need more than just a suggestion. They're going to need a how, a who, a why, and right now they don't seem to have it. And that brings us to the missing pieces of this case, the things we still don't know. The big one, who else's DNA was at the scene? Investigators found other unidentified DNA, but we still don't have a full picture of what that exactly means. Was it trace evidence from visitors, something more sinister? It was a party house. People were coming and going all through even that night. You will find more DNA at that scene. It's far more important where you are finding it than anything else. So that's a small gap in the story. And then there's the matter of motive. If Koberger did this, why? Prosecutors don't necessarily need to prove motive, but jurors do like a reason. And right now, the prosecution's best argument is that Koberger was fixated on at least one of his victims. His prior cell phone pings near their home suggest he was watching them, but the connection is still murky. Was it an obsession, a rejection, a crime of opportunity? And finally, the missing murder weapon. If Koberger did this, where is it? If he was framed, where is the real killer's knife? Who would frame him? Why would they be framing him? You know, reality. That's the last missing piece, because until that weapon is found, there will always be an opening, I guess, for doubt. And in a case like this, doubt is one thing that the defense needs the jury to hold on to. But is it enough? It's a question we'll find out when this actually goes to trial. If you have an opinion on this case, and it's hard not to, please leave it in the comments section on YouTube. If you're on a podcast platform and there's a comments there, go for it or not. Go check out our YouTube channel as well. You can watch every single thing that we do here in the studio on camera and our interviews and our guests and clips and all sorts of stuff that we play here. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening or watching and let your friends know we exist. We can't do this without your support. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. She was the perfect wife, always smiling, always supportive. A pillar of the community, beloved by friends, adored by family, and secretly researching undetectable poisons in her spare time. Maybe it was the way he chewed. Maybe she just got bored. Or maybe, just maybe, she had been planning this since the honeymoon. But if he had just paid attention, if he had just known what to look for, if he had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and learned the red flags, he could have heard every episode of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Ad-free, and before everyone else, he could have seen it coming. Instead, he's 6 feet under, and she's shopping for husband number two. Don't be like him. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Grown Up Stuff.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Grown Up Stuff.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Grown Up Stuff.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Grown Up Stuff.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Leah, and we're from the Grown Up Stuff podcast.
And just in time for tax season, on this week's episode, we're chatting with CPA Lisa Green Lewis about how small businesses can tackle their taxes using TurboTax Business.
A Forbes study mentioned that a whopping 93% of small businesses overpay their taxes. And 17% of Gen Zers believed that you could write off any expense as a business expense. So
can't blame them.
It's really important to do your taxes right.
Listen to Grown Up Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.